For interviews on educational technology and for a list of our educational technology workshops, please visit www.edtechlive.com. To join in the discussion on School 2.0, please visit www.school20.net. And for discounted Dell computers, please visit our sponsor, www.k12computers.com.
Really, the structure of school and the way that school occurs and the power relationships in classrooms and schools has remained largely unchanged for at least 100 years, and in reality going back even more. And so when you're talking about transformation, the technology in most cases hasn't led to a transformation in the structure, in the power relationships, and in the activities that are occurring in the classrooms. When we look at what they're actually doing with the technology, they use it more outside of the classroom. The newer teachers use it more outside of the classroom than older, more experienced teachers. But in the classroom, they actually use it less. We've been investing a lot in getting the tools and the equipment and the pieces all in place. And I think there's real potential now for some new models and new practices to be applied that can capitalize on those resources that are almost fully in place.
Hi, this is Steve Hargadon, and it's Monday, April 9th, 2007. Welcome to EdTech Live. Today, my guest is Mike Russell from Boston College. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Steve.
Well, I really enjoyed listening to your presentation at the COSIN conference in San Francisco, and I've told you just how fun it's been for me over the last several days to read your material and to be thinking about your topic. The title of that session at COSIN,
I think it was, "Where is the Technology Revolution in Education?"
Perfect. So there have been a couple of articles this past week that really look negatively upon the impact of certain kinds of software and educational technology. And I think a lot of people are asking questions about the value of technology in education. We've spent a lot of money on computers. The ratio of computers to students is certainly much better than it was. The level of connections, of internet connections at schools, is significantly increased. So what's the problem?
Well, I think there's a couple issues. One is, I think these studies, I haven't had a chance to read these studies in full, but I am familiar with their designs. And, the studies are focusing on kind of old technologies in some ways that are designed to have very specific impacts on learning. I'm not sure about the tests that were being used for those studies. But oftentimes we've seen that today's tests aren't always sensitive to the types of learning that tend to occur with technology. Secondly, we all know that when an intervention is put in place in a school, whether it's technology-based or otherwise, different people implement it in different ways. So there's always questions about fidelity of interventions, and it's tough to tell in these studies. Again, I haven't read them in detail yet, but it's tough to tell to know whether differences in the fidelity of implementation also may be influencing the results. I mean, one of the undercurrents of the study is that they found a fair amount of variation across sites, which would suggest that there is differences in how these tools were being used in the classrooms. But the bottom line is, in my opinion, people keep thinking about technology. When they say that, they mean computers, and when they really say that, they mean using a specific application for a specific purpose. And it's very kind of old school way of thinking of one tool for one purpose with one outcome. In reality, I think computers are much more powerful than that. They're really toolboxes. There's a lot of different ways that it can be used. And the computer, when it's connected to the internet, opens up a whole world of opportunities. And when you try to isolate the impact of one specific use on one specific area of the curriculum, you're very likely going to be missing the bigger picture.
I think that you did a really nice job in your presentation of discussing the different ways in which computers can be used in the classroom. Are you willing to go over that again? I think you called it the four contexts.
I mean, traditionally, you see computers being used kind of in the business class context, where you're either trying to develop very specific business-related skills, such as learning how to use a spreadsheet to do accounting and budgeting and so forth, learning how to use keyboards, obviously to develop keyboarding skills. Then also kind of computer classes themselves, where you're students are learning how to do programming and using other kind of graphic artist-related tools. Now there's Java and web page development as well. So, you know, those are kind of two different contexts. One is developing business-related tools, and another is developing computer-based skills. There's a third context tends to be for writing, and that tends to occur across curricular areas. And then fourth is really what I think of and what Hank Becker actually called more of experimentation. You know, Hank, when he did his work in the late 90s, found that there was more experimentation occurring in the elementary grade levels. But now I think it kind of occurs across the board, where some teachers get turned on to a piece of software or a use of computers for some purpose, and they play around with it, and they try to get a feel for it, and they're experimenting with it. But it doesn't necessarily become either part of the curriculum or a tool that's used regularly throughout a course or across courses.
So would a lot of the tools of the Read-Write Web or Web 2.0, would they fall into that fourth context?
Yeah, I think so at this point. Yeah, definitely. One of the things you're starting to see in very isolated areas is people starting to think about how you can use technology to really open up learning, create really different opportunities for kids to learn, and in some sense kind of allowing learning to be personalized and tailored to kids' interests and current needs. But that's extremely isolated, and I think that's the piece where there's real potential for technology to impact education, but which a lot of the research that has occurred in the past is missing those impacts. Even if they try to measure them, the methodology would probably be blind to those impacts.
So would it be fair to say in summary that, at least to this point in time, the use of computers in the classroom, which is perceived and probably accurately as not having really transformed education, is really just like having very expensive pencils in the classroom?
Yeah, it's more than pencils, but yeah, it's somewhat similar to having expensive traditional resources. You know, in many cases, all you've taken are paper-based and pencil-based learning and transformed it into an electronic medium. That's not to say that transformation isn't effective. I mean, in my presentation and some of my past work, it's clear that if kids are writing with computers regularly throughout the learning or throughout the writing process, they end up writing more, and in the process develop better writing skills. So that's a very positive outcome, but it's not transformative in any way.
So have the one-to-one programs shown any more capability of being transformative in the way that you're thinking?
No, that's a great question. One of the things that we have seen in one-to-one programs that we've looked at, and we've looked at, depending on how you count, 6 to 7 different programs, mostly in the New England area, is, you know, the presence, one-to-one computing leads to much, much more use of the technology. So kids will be using it much more during the course of the day, and teachers will obviously use it more as well. The uses tend to be very similar to what kids were doing prior to having the technology in play. So, you know, what it's doing is changing the tools that kids are working with, but we haven't seen examples where it's really transforming the process of education. You know, you still tend to have kids in the classroom, at their desk, working individually or in small groups. Teachers still spending a lot of the time in front of the classrooms talking to the kids. And, you know, instead of doing stuff on paper, instead of going down to the library to find information, they're using the computers to produce products and the internet to find information. So it doesn't really change what kids are doing or when they're doing it. It's just the tool that they're using tends to change.
So I'm interested by the concept of transforming education, and I'm thinking that it's partly informed by having looked at transformations that have taken place in business, but I'm also wondering if it isn't informed by the personal changes that we as individuals are going through in our own learning environments. Meaning, as I use the tools of the Read-Write Web, as I look to Wikipedia, as I contribute, as I'm part of networks on the web, I've noticed that as I listen to podcasts, I've noticed that my own learning has really been transformed. Why is it important that we transform education? Isn't education okay as it is?
Well, I think for some kids, education probably is pretty good the way it is. It works for some kids, but there's other kids where it's not working, or it's not working as well as it can. And I think part of the power of computer-based technologies is that they allow people to have more control over what it is they're looking at, it when they're looking at information, and how they're looking at it. And when I say look, you know, that's part of the power. Is sometimes you are literally reading. Sometimes you're having things read to you. Sometimes you're getting information through video or other multimedia sources. And some people prefer one over the other. And so, you know, the technology allows us sometimes to access the same types of information in different ways at our own choosing. And, you know, you mentioned podcasts. One of the things I find, I do a lot of running and biking, and for me, podcasts have become really powerful in that they allow me to keep up with the news when I'm exercising. And so, you know, what I do is download all my news source, you know, as podcasts. And, you know, when I'm out for an hour and a half run, that's what I'm doing. I'm catching up on what I'm missing otherwise. And for me, that's how I get a lot of my information. I don't tend to read a lot of newspapers. For other people, sitting down and reading newspapers or reading information on the BBC or NPR or, you know, whatever their news source on the internet might be, is the way they get their information. And so that's a very small part of the transformation that could be occurring in education, where you're allowing kids more flexibility in the sources of information and the tools that they're using while they're learning. But that's really just the tip of the iceberg. You know, there's so much more that's happening in the world of business that I think has implications for education as well.
Well, before we go there, because I do want to definitely talk about some of the things that you have seen in business that you think could be powerful, guidelines for understanding the kinds of transformations that could take place. I was also very interested in the sort of short history that you gave of education and why our educational system is the way it is. Is that something that I could ask you to cover as well?
Sure. Let me just flip to my notes so I don't leave too much out here. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I really love the photographs, the comparisons, and I think, you know, one was an obvious comparison, and it was, I think, Boston School from 100 years ago and kids sitting in desks in rows. And then it looked like almost the same classroom or the same school. And it, what may have been actually the same desks, but, you know, kids sitting in rows in the same format. The one that took me by surprise, though, was that you then showed a photograph of kids grouped around laptops. And it looked very modern. I mean, you know, the expectation at that point in seeing the slide was, oh, you know, look at how the computer has transformed things. And then you showed a slide of kids in the 1930s grouped around typewriters. And it was very effective because it seemed to indicate that while the tools may look a little bit different, the actual structure, physical structure of the education seems to be the same.
Yeah, that the second set of pictures, the laptop and then the keyboarding is, or not, I mean the typewriting, is really interesting. Back in the early 30s, there was a gentleman, Ben Wood, and he had a partner, I can't remember his name, did a very large-scale study looking at typewriter use in the early elementary grades. And, you know, the study involved something like 10,000 students in a large chunk of the Northeast of the country. And it was a large study. I think it lasted for 3 years, if I remember correctly. And, you know, it was randomized. Some classrooms were giving these typewriters. Some weren't. And there was, you know, analysis on, you know, how kids' learning changed, particularly their reading and writing. And, you know, what it showed is that, in fact, that the places, the classrooms that had the typewriters and were being used saw increases in kids' reading and increases in kids' writing skills. And, you know, what's interesting to me, there's a few things that's interesting about it. One is that study is very similar to the types of studies that are done today with computers or laptops. You know, where you're giving some kids a tool and an intervention, and other kids you're not. Secondly, you know, one of the findings is that it depends on the implementation. You know, there's some places where the keyboard or the typewriters didn't make a big difference, and other classrooms where they were used a lot and they did make a big difference. This story is exactly the same as, you know, what we were talking about earlier. We see the same thing with today's computer-based technology tools. But, you know, for me, the really interesting thing is exactly what you said, that when you look at the images of those classrooms from the 1930s and today's classrooms, the structure, the tool's different, you know, a typewriter versus a laptop, but the structure of the classrooms and what seems to be occurring in the classrooms is pretty much the same. You know, if you don't have a tool for everybody, you tend to have a handful of kids working with that tool, and the other kids are off in another part of the room, often working with the teachers doing something else. And the teachers end up setting up these rotational systems so they can move kids in and on and off of the technology, and they tend to have kind of different activities going on in the room at the same time. But I think more importantly, you also tend to have the teacher in complete control of the classroom and of what kids are doing with the technology. And, you know, when you're talking about the history of education, you know, I think when you look at the images either from the early 1900s of the Boston Latin classroom to today's Boston Latin classrooms, or these rooms with the laptops versus the typewriters, is really the structure of school and the way that school occurs, and the power relationships in classrooms and schools has remained largely unchanged for at least 100 years, and in reality going back even more. And so when you're talking about transformation, the technology in most cases hasn't led to a transformation in the structure, in the power relationships, and in the activities that are occurring in the classrooms.
It was very interesting for me to read your history of the charity schools and then the common schools and then the decisions at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century and what appeared to me to be sort of three vying philosophies of schooling. And I'm not sure I realized just how distinctly our school system really reflects the structure and format of the Industrial Revolution. I think I knew that to some degree, but I don't think I had made the connection so clearly.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's people talk about a factory model of schooling, and I think oftentimes when they use that term, they kind of think about kids being moved almost as an assembly line through through either grade levels or within a grade level, particularly in the middle and high schools, kind of moving from, you know, you got English first, now you're moving to math class and to science class and then to social studies and what, and then to lunch and then wherever you're going to go after that. And so they kind of think of it as assembly line, either being processed through the grade levels or processed through different topic areas in a given day. But in reality, there's much more to this notion of a factory model of education. And it really does, in my mind, date back to around the mid-1800s, when you start to have the formation or the transfer from what were called charity schools back then. And charity schools were schools run primarily by Protestant organizations for students who today we would say are at severe risk. These are kids whose parents were generally low income, uneducated, oftentimes didn't have jobs, were believed to engage in criminal activities. And the fundamental belief was that if you allow kids to remain in that environment, they're going to become tomorrow's criminals. So the charity schools would take these kids in and try to give them an education. Of course, they're operating with a very limited budget, and so they had to try to start thinking about efficiencies in their educational models. And of course, that's the time when the Industrial Revolution is really occurring, and you're starting to really see factories and factory models of production starting to develop, and it really takes off in the early 1900s. But this whole notion of efficiency and applying models of efficiency to schooling, it starts to take place in that 1850s. And about that same time, there was a model of schooling called the Lancasterian model that, again, it was an efficient model where you had a single teacher who had some kind of almost star pupils, star students that would serve as his or her assistants, usually his. And those assistants would then work with groups of students. Students would cycle through the assistants, slowly weaving their way up until they had developed enough knowledge and skills to interact with the head teacher. And so right there is, 1830, 1850s, you have this real, true assembly line model of efficiency where, in the extreme, you could have one teacher working with 800 kids. That efficiency then, as we started developing common schools, which were really kind of the first public schools, again, in the mid to late 1800s, they had taxes, they had more revenue, but they tended to adopt these efficiency models to education. That then led into the expansion into middle school and high schools around the turn of the century.
As I've listened to you make that description, I've wondered, those who had the resources, the wealthy in our society, are there models for the kind of schooling they give their children, tutoring, that were significantly different than what was taking place in the public education sphere?
That's a good question. I haven't ever studied the kind of private school evolution of private schools, but I suspect that if you look at least the private schools that I'm familiar with, they tended not to take in huge numbers of kids the way that our public schools did. I mean, you have to remember that in 1900, there's only like one out of eight kids were graduating high school. And there was only about 2 out of 10 kids that were actually attending high school. And by the late 40s, early 50s, those numbers skyrocketed, so that you had about, I think, if I remember correctly, it was about 7 out of 10 kids were graduating. Eight out of 10 kids were attending, and I think it was like getting close to 7 out of 10 were graduating by the late 40s, early 50s. And so you had this huge explosion of kids going into public schools that you didn't have happening with private schools because they're selective in their enrollments. So, you know, I haven't studied this, but I suspect that what happened in private schools is they tended to maintain a much more intimate learning environment. And that doesn't mean that it's still not teacher-directed, but it tended to be more intimate, where the teachers could work more closely with individual students or small groups of students without having to focus on huge numbers and this notion of efficiency.
Well, I think part of what's so fascinating to me about the technologies, the read-write web, and the things that are happening is that I'm watching educators who are using the tools of the read-write web and becoming actively engaged. And they begin to, or they at least are expressing that they're feeling a sense of engagement and excitement about their learning outside of traditional environments that's different than what they've experienced before. And then they're looking at traditional education and they're saying, boy, this is different than my personal learning experience. And so they're beginning to open the door in an interesting way. The use of technology is allowing them to open the door to the questions of pedagogy and questioning, well, we've always known that not every third grader is going to be at the same level to learn the same things, but in this model of scarce resources, there's really not a whole lot we can do about that third grader who's not on the same track as the others, or the, you know, the fact that they're all at different points. But now maybe technology gives us an opportunity to actually rethink learning. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I can reflect on just my own teaching at the university level. Over the last, 5 to 7 years, you know, I've become much more dependent on really email for having exchanges with students. Sometimes, you know, it's an email that's sent to the whole class clarifying something that we were talking about in class or an assignment or, you know, a student had a question. I think the answer is relevant to everybody. But most of the time, what it really is engaging in conversations individually with students, you know, often about topics of their interest. So right now I'm teaching a research methods class, and each student has their own research interest. And so, and some of them have very different needs relevant to the research interests. You know, so, for example, one student has a strong interest in working with effectively homeless people who are very difficult to sample. And so her questions and her interests within the research study is, how do I design a study so I'm getting a representative sample of homeless people so that she can study her topic of interest related to homeless people? Other students are working with more easily defined and easy to access populations, and their interests, A, their topics are different, and B, their research challenges are very different. And so, you know, even though it's a fairly traditional course, college level, you know, with a lot of lecture kind of lecture format, outside of class, the internet and email has allowed me to really personalize the learning in a way that 5 to 7 years ago wasn't really happening. Students could come into my office hours on a very limited basis and engage in those conversations, but office hours had to be convenient for them. They had to have their questions well formulated when they came in to get their 15 minutes benefit, and I would have to be able to respond off the top of my head while talking to them. With email, all that goes away. They can interact with me at any time. We are able to think before we respond to each other. They can go dig up additional information to answer questions that I might have, and vice versa. I can go up into the internet or some of my own files and pull out examples for them to look at that are relevant to whatever their interests are. So that's, again, it's a really small example of how, you know, really the internet and a basic tool like email has really, in my own personal teaching, changed the interactions that I'm having with students and has allowed me to really personalize my instruction in a way that didn't happen 5 to 7 years ago.
Now, if I'm an educator and I'm listening to this, do I get a little afraid that that this is going to become super time consuming? I mean, can you give some sense of whether or not this actually creates a different model that's as efficient or more efficient than the regular way of teaching, or do you find that you're now from 5 in the morning till 11 at night at the beck and call of your students?
Well, I think, again, that's part of the transformation process. I think if you layer this on top of the way things currently occur in the classroom for most K-12 teachers, it would, it very well could become burdensome. Just, you know, on top of everything else that you have to do, now spending time at home and on the weekends answering all your students' emails would be a huge additional burden. But it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, if you think about kind of restructuring and transforming the way teaching and learning occurs in the classroom, you could effectively free up time for teachers to engage in these types of conversations. One of the things I talked about in my talk at COSIN was, you know, are there things, elements of teaching that are high effort, low reward for teachers, meaning, you know, it takes a lot of their time and effort, but there's very little that they learn about their students or that their students learn from them that could effectively be outsourced so that the teacher's not the one doing that, and instead freeing up his or her time to have these types of interactions, one-on-one individual interactions with their students. And the example I used is, you know, grading of homework in many classes. It's, you know, for 80% of the students in a class, there's probably not a lot of value gained by having the teacher, the main teacher, doing all of that grading. They're essentially seeing that answers are correct, marking answers correct, telling students that they're doing a good job. It's only for, you know, say 20% of the students who are routinely having problems that there's value in having the teacher closely look at their work. But even in identifying that 20%, you could probably outsource grading or analysis of student work and then have information returned to the teachers that are focusing them on those kids that are in need. And, you know, that's just one small example of how you might be able to use the technology to transform both who's doing what I think a lot of people would probably say is mundane activities that you probably don't need all the teacher skills, the classroom teacher skill to be doing, and instead allow those teachers to have more time to interact with their kids, either face-to-face or you know, through some kind of email, internet exchange.
Well, I'd like to move to some of the things that you have seen take place in business, the transformations that have taken place in business. But before we do that, I just wanted to bring up one thing that that we didn't mention that I thought was intriguing from your talk. And that was that, if I read it correctly, you said that we've sort of waited for the next generation of teachers who would be coming out of technically savvy backgrounds, the maybe digital natives, to speak, coming forward, and that they would actually kind of bring more transformative uses of technologies into the classroom. And I think you said that statistically they may actually even be bringing less in.
Well, what we're finding, yeah, exactly. There's been this belief, and people have been talking about this since really kind of the late 90s, that as older teachers have been teaching for a long time, start retiring, and we start bringing in a new crop of teachers, many of whom would have grown up in the quote-unquote digital age and would have comfort with technology, that it's those people, that new group of teachers coming in who have technology skill and confidence that really will start being the users of technology in schools. And so, you know, we're starting to see those new teachers come into the classrooms. And when we looked at what those teachers are actually doing, what we found was that, in fact, these teachers do report that they have better technology skills. They do believe that they're more confident. They report higher levels of confidence working with technology. But when we look at what they're actually doing with the technology, they use it more outside of the classroom. The newer teachers use it more outside of the classroom than older, more experienced teachers. But in the classroom, they actually use it less. So, you know, in terms of transforming or increasing use of technology in the classroom, the newer group of teachers, you know, just because they're there doesn't mean there's automatic increases in technology use. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is, you know, our teacher education programs still are not doing a very good job in preparing teachers to use technology in the classroom. So they're coming in with good content knowledge, they're coming in with good pedagogical knowledge, but not good technology pedagogical knowledge. And so there's a little bit of a learning process that has to occur for them once they get into a school that has lots of technology. Second is, when a new teacher comes into any school, you know, the first few years of teaching is extremely difficult. They have to get to know the school culture. They have to get to know the students. They have to get to know the curriculum. They then have to develop their own skills teaching and delivering their curriculum. And so, since technology often wasn't a big component of their teacher education programs, there just simply isn't time for them to become familiar with the technology that's available in the schools, and then to think about how to integrate it themselves. Third component, you know, is when you have strong technology integration specialists in a school, they're going to work with people who they know and who are likely to be high payoff users, and those people that are likely to use the technology if they get some assistance. And again, the new teachers are put at a little bit of a disadvantage because they're not known to anybody, and everyone knows that they're extremely busy with everything else. So, they, you know, in some of the schools we looked at, they tend not to get as much support as you might think they would get during their first year or two of teaching. So, those three factors combine to partially explain why these folks aren't using technology as much as I think people anticipate they would.
That was really surprising.
Yeah, we were really surprised.
At COSIN, Keith Kruger talked about how in the early 1980s, there was a pervasive feeling in business that we had spent a lot of money on bringing computers and automation into American businesses, but that there had been no actual payoff, and that if anything, maybe efficiencies were down. Clearly, you know, 25 years from there, we feel that computer technology has dramatically transformed our nation's business culture. So you've obviously seen some things take place in the use of computers in business that you feel can help us to understand some of the potential for changes in education. Do you want to start covering that?
Sure. Yeah, let me just comment on what you just said first, too. I think it was Thomas Friedman in his book, The World is Flat, kind of talked about that. And I believe he it was in that book that he spent a fair amount of time kind of doing an analysis of kind of the whole technology boom in the stock market in the late 90s, mid to late 90s. And, you know, effectively, what I took away from his argument was that, you know, at that time there was a lot of boom and bust, and, you know, a lot of things were happening. But the most important thing that was happening was you were laying a groundwork. You know, wires were getting laid all over the place. And, you know, a lot of businesses were trying to figure out how to capitalize on this wiring that was being laid. And, you know, a lot of people didn't do well in trying to figure this out initially. But now that we're, you know, almost 10 years later, in fact, businesses are starting to take advantage of all that wire that was laid. And in some sense, I think, you know, we're kind of almost at the same point in education, where we've been investing a lot in getting the tools and the equipment and the pieces all in place. And I think there's real potential now for some new models and new practices to be applied that can capitalize on those resources that are almost fully in place. And I think, you know, as you said, some of what might happen might parallel what we've seen happen in the business world. And I in that talk, I identified six themes that have kind of occurred in the business world that I think have potential application to education. One of them is this notion of expanding to get smaller. This notion of allowing your business and the products that you are trying to sell to expand, so that you can, and in the process of not with the expectation of selling a lot of all those products, but instead with the expectation of creating a lot of niches, specialized niches for which small sets of products will be very attractive. And the fundamental shift is that in a traditional brick and mortar store, you couldn't have that large of a stock and have access to a large enough niche that would make it profitable. But when you go into an internet world, or a national or a world market, you can connect niches across geographic locations to end up having a substantial client base that then makes it worth trying to cater to multiple small niches. And, again, I think that has application to education, where, within schools, when you're talking about students' interests and needs, it may be very difficult to get enough students with a given need or interest to justify investing resources to meet those needs. If there's only one or two kids who have when I say special need, I don't mean a learning need. I mean a need at that point in time in their learning. If there's only one or two, it's hard to justify spending a few thousand dollars for some special software or some special tool to meet those kids' individual need or interest. But if you can connect those kids across schools, you now can end up having cohorts or groups of 20, 30 kids, and now it becomes justifiable and feasible to be spending that $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 for that group of kids. And so this notion of expanding your outreach so that you can have your outreach be targeted has clearly made a number of businesses really successful, and I think it has implications for school as well. Outsourcing, I mentioned that as well. A lot of businesses are now outsourcing components of their business. In the talk, I made this distinction between relocation versus outsourcing. A lot of people think of outsourcing as just moving a whole business to another country where labor is cheaper. That's really not what outsourcing is about. Outsourcing, when done effectively, is identifying that part of your business which is necessary but tends to be mundane and detracts from the real value that your business has to offer. So, for example, one of the examples I used was in fast food restaurants. The actual taking of orders, of drive-through orders, is very time-consuming and distracting for people who are trying to do other things, like actually prepare the meals, put drink orders together, French fry orders together, and then deliver it to the customer. So that process of taking in information, putting it in the computer while you're also preparing orders, it's distracting, and so that has, in some cases, has been outsourced. So people outside of the actual restaurant are taking these orders, sending those orders into the restaurant, and then the people in the restaurants are focusing only on preparing and delivering those orders. Doing that leads to increased efficiencies, number of orders that can be processed, and decreases in errors. Same thing in education. There are parts of what a teacher does or what a school does that are somewhat mundane. They're important, but they're mundane, and they might be done better and more efficiently by someone outside of the classroom or outside of the school. And so if there's ways of identifying some of those, like grading initial analysis of student work, you could allow people to focus on the core business of teaching instead of some of these more mundane required aspects. Collaborative development is another example. In business, you're seeing this all over the place, whether it's development of software, or the example I used in my talk was a company, I believe it's called Gold Corp, that was a mining company that, you know, they had all kinds of data on some land that they owned and was they believed had minerals on them, but they were unable to identify those minerals. And so what they did is they opened up all that data and put out a challenge to anyone who wanted to partake to try to, based on the data, predict where resources were located. And so instead of having their handful of engineers and analysts inside of the company working with this data, they end up having many, many more people outside the company engaged in the challenge of identifying resources. And in the end, they are able to become much more profitable by this kind of collaborative, in this case, identification of where resources might be. Wikipedia is another example where you have massive amounts of information coming together by people in the field, users contributing their knowledge, expertise, and vetting that information. In education, there's real potential for similar effects with collaborative development, whether it's textbooks. I mean, you talk to many teachers, and they're frustrated because textbooks have more information than they feel they need. Sometimes that information's out of date or is inaccurate. They're stuck with a paper-based textbook. It's too expensive to replace it as information is updated or inaccuracies are corrected. If you could have collaborative development of textbooks, you could have teachers and other experts, retired teachers, retired experts, anyone who has an interest in education or the topic that the textbook is covering, contributing information, and then teachers, depending on the students they're working with, state standards, their needs, whatever, could then tailor the content of the quote-unquote textbooks that they're using. So both you have multiple people collaborating to the development of the quote-unquote textbook, and then you have tailoring, teachers or schools tailoring what the textbooks actually contain so that they're really focused on what they hope their students are learning. So those are just three examples, I think, of what's happening in the business world that could have potential applications to education if we were to really open up our schools and use the technology more effectively.
I will say that after reading in those six areas, I couldn't stop thinking about all of the ideas that kind of came up for me. Where does the participation of the students come into that model? You know, for me, clearly the ability of a student to create, say, a podcast of a book review that actually gets listened to by other students is so compelling. The creation of content, this idea that the student could actually become an historian, you know, and even in certain cases be looking at source documents that would otherwise not be important enough to be seen by somebody else and actually participate in the process of creating knowledge. How does that fit in?
Well, I think, you know, that's definitely part of the collaborative development as well. And, you know, one of the other themes that I didn't talk about is this notion of individualization. That is, kids could choose to show their knowledge and understanding through different mechanisms. And so, you know, maybe one student does create a podcast, another student might create some interactive flash-based tool to demonstrate their understanding of some physics concept or a statistical concept like correlation. And so you could have students demonstrating their knowledge and putting up tools and resources that other kids could then turn around and use to help them develop their knowledge and understanding of concepts. I'm experimenting with this in my class, my research methods class right now, where I've asked students to form, or actually I guess I assign them into groups of three or four. Each group is supposed to develop their own wiki research primer that's supposed to kind of identify the main concepts and topics that we explore in the course. And, you know, I'm doing this to help them try to solidify their understanding and so that I can learn what they think is most important about what we're talking about. But ultimately, what I can do the next time I teach this course is open these up and make them available to everybody so that, you know, the students, you know, some of them may end up going out and buy the $80 textbook, Others may see this research primer along with, you know, the other materials that I provide in the course sufficient for their learning materials, and that ultimately I might ask students or allow students then to refine these research primers that are put up there so that over time they're improved, they're expanded upon, and now it becomes both a learning tool for the students as well as a way for me to look at what kids are learning from the course I'm teaching. Same thing could happen in maybe not down at the K level, but in upper elementary through high school, certainly. And so the students could really be developing contributing to the development of learning tools as well.
Michael, fascinating topic. Let me express my appreciation for the thoughtfulness with which you've approached it and the degree to which I really enjoyed going over the materials and for taking the time today to talk about it.
Oh, I appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun.